Yes.
So yeah, it's possible. Unless, yeah, okay. We can take it up again, of course.
Yeah. So I guess, I mean, the fundamental question that I had was about his use of the word Antahkarana. In these chapters, it seems that he is using it even to refer to the manas and the
Chitta.
Manas and the Buddhi and the Chitta. Somehow I thought that by Antahkarana was meant the inner mind, the inner vital, the subtle physical. But that doesn't seem to be how he's using it here.
Yeah, actually, you see, he is and he isn't, because if you know the first one, first chapter, he is first establishing the traditional idea of the Antahkarana,
Oh
which
yeah,
is,
correct. What is usually known as, yes, okay. So he's qualified that, right?
he's qualified that, and then he's saying that for our purposes, this will largely suffice, but we need to add a few elements to it,
Beautiful,
so
yes.
to
And
speak.
that's what he does further down in that same paragraph.
Correct, correct.
Okay. That explains,
So,
yeah.
you know, the idea of inner mind, inner vital, subtle physical is something that he introduces little later in his own kind of writing.
Got it.
And this
Now
is one
that.
of the chapters he did not revise.
Sure,
So
that makes sense then.
all these chapters he didn't
Okay.
revise. So you find that he uses terms slightly differently from the way he uses it later. Particularly, these are the chapters where he uses the term psychic prana, as you, in a way very different from the use of the psychic later.
Very much so, yes.
And when he actually talks about the psychic being, he doesn't call it the psychic being, though he calls it the true soul.
Yes.
You know, so that's why this chapter is a little tricky, but you know, these chapters are very, very important, very
Yes,
powerful.
Debashishta, yes, very rich to understand the interactions of the, I mean, this is something that just doesn't get into the head by simply reading, because we have read
Yeah.
Planes and Parts of the Being like about many dozen times. But even
Correct.
then, the chapter 5 especially, it just shows the interactions very well.
Right. So between the three of them, I think the three chapters, he reinforces the ideas because he repeats them. You know, he first introduces them in a certain way, and then you know, he goes through the same ideas twice again in the next chapter, and the third chapter he goes through the mental instrument. So you know, he covers the grounds quite thoroughly.
Yes, very much so.
But what can also, I mean, what even adds more to it is, if you look at the Record of Yoga part 2, you know, the scribal notes at the end.
Okay, let me just bring that just a moment.
In one short sentence, he has said, defined what psychic prana is, and I understood that to be the desire soul.
So vital, right? Vital.
Yeah, it's a
In the
little
vital.
bit unclear, because you know, he talks about the desire soul as something like a formation which arises out of the chitta, more or less. But he also uses the term emotional mind. But when he's using the term psychic prana, I mean, he has defined it in a couple of places as the vital mentality, he calls it. So the vital mentality, and he's also thinking about it in terms of, you know, what we call the subjectivity, you know, the sort of inner consciousness, the shakti of the vital mind, you may say. Not a structure. Like, if you call it the desired soul, that's a structure, right? But what is flowing from that structure, what is flowing out through that structure, that is the psychic prana. as he thinks about the outlines over there. And you know, it's sort of like the vital mentality. You'll see it two or three times he uses that term for it. So it has to be understood more in terms of a flow through a channel between structures. And of course, you know, like he talks about the purification of the psychic prana, which ultimately, you know, rests, it gets its stamp of defect from the evolution, as he says, which is the separate sense of separateness rooted in the body. And because it is so closely tied to the senses, and you know, sort of, I mean, mediates between the body and the mind, it carries that kind of quality of, you know, defect from the body to the mind, so to say.
What we, you wanted to say something about the scribal notes of the record of yoga, part 2.
Yeah. You notice that scribal notes, record of yoga, part 2.
Okay. Let me check where.
Towards the bottom, towards the end of the book.
Yeah, the scribblings. 13.
No, it will be called scribal notes.
Automatic writings. The scribblings is what it says in this.
After the automatic writings, what does it say?
After that, we have appendix.
No. There is Sapta Chatushtaya
scribal,
scribal version
1416.
That's the one. 1416. Now, what that is a little bit questionable. What that is that, you know, from 1912, 1913, thereabouts, or maybe 1914, to about 1920, I mean, not that long, for a short period in between, he was giving talks on the Sapta Chatushtaya to the group of disciples, and they took down notes. So scribal notes are, you know, what has been done really is that a variety of notebooks, about four or five different versions, have been put side by side and then kind of collated, compiled into this version that you see over there. So, you know, if something kind of doesn't jive exactly, you know, they've kind of, I mean, sort of tried to bring it in from another version or something like that, so that what you get is this so-called scribal notes. A scribal version. These are his talks, so to say.
Okay, we haven't read that.
Yeah. So if you go to the Siddhi Chatushtaya part, which is, you know, it will come after the Jnana Chatushtaya, I think.
Yeah, Ashta Siddhi. Oh no, that
after
is
that.
Partly a part of Vidyana. Yes, Samadhi no Noi.
After the Samadhi.
After that came Sharira Chatushtaya.
Okay, then go beyond.
Beyond the Sharira. The
next?
Is...
After Sharira.
Oh, somehow comes to an end. No, there is a Siddhi Chatushtaya, very last. Yeah.
Last one is Siddhi Chatushtaya.
Yeah.
So there you'll find it begins with Shuddhi, right?
Yes, Shuddhi is the first one.
There's quite a lot there. There's two pages on Shuddhi over there. It starts with the pranas.
Yes.
Then it goes on to Chitta, Manas and Buddhi. And it's quite interesting because there you find that all that you're reading in all these chapters get kind of really tightly kind of encapsulated.
And when this the record notes were written and the synthesis of yoga were written, the terminologies were fairly similar, correct?
This these chapters of the Yoga of Self-Perfection was sort of written in the same period that he was writing the record.
Okay.
So they follow the same terminology. Later he modified some chapters, but you know, some of them he left as they were. Like these are the chapters he left just as they were.
I was given to understand that the whole of the fourth book, that is the Yoga of Self-Perfection, has been largely untouched. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct.
Debashita, when they were publishing the Arya, that is 1914 to 1920, Sri Aurobindo seemed to have written most of the books that we are reading. And then from 20 to 50, there is just like Savitri and some revisions.
Yes, correct.
Savitri revisions and probably the collections which became letters, right?
Oh, letters.
Exactly. So that's the reason why the letters represent in a way the record of the changes in terminology. The most kind of authentic, you know, history of changes in terminology can be found in the letters. So, in a way, if the letters are carried in a historical form, rather than how they are right now they are kind of carried in a sort of subject-wise form, you know, kind of computerized version which allows you to
tag them,
search
right.
along different keywords, would be ideal, I think, for somebody to get a sense of how the terminology changes.
Because without that background, it can be like quite baffling that even you can say it can become incoherent that the same word is used to mean different things, right?
Yeah, quite right. That's why, unless one, you know, this is one of the major problems of Sri Aurobindo. Because when I first came across Synthesis of Yoga, I had nobody to tell me that, you know, psychic prana doesn't mean the same as psychic being, and it was a real confusion when I first read it. So one can intuit right away that there's something wrong. He's talking about something else here, but still it took quite a long time until, and there's no clear you know, kind of book or anything that tells you the history of the terminology, so it is a confusion that continues to exist in people's minds.
So, I mean, if to take this analogy, is it possible that works like the Upanishads and the Vedas also have similar, you know, quote-unquote issues?
Yeah, very possible, because I don't know about the Veda, but definitely with the Upanishads, there is a kind of a chronology to the Upanishads. And there are people, and Sri Aurobindo himself talks about the early Upanishads and the later Upanishads. And in fact, he sees a drift in the kind of, you know, goals of the Upanishads from the early to the later Upanishads as, you know, and continuing with a certain confusion, as he says, because there are two goals, as we know, the goal of moksha and the goal of Jivan Mukti. And the early Upanishads are prioritizing Jivan Mukti, but the later ones are prioritizing moksha. And in either case, both are present. Particularly the later ones have both of them, because that's the hybrid nature of those texts. And it's difficult to tell which is being prioritized sometimes.
Devajita, Sri Aurobindo talks about the purification of the channels.
Yeah.
Right? The way, these are, of course, the subtle channels, or maybe level channels at different levels. There is
the
Nadi Shuddhi.
Where is it? Where is it, Lopa?
Where is it? You were reading the last three chapters. Maybe it came in the purification chapters.
Yeah.
So there is a technique called Nadi Shuddhi.
Right.
And that is what it is, right?
But he is not paying too much attention to that Nadi Shuddhi. he's not proceeding along those lines, you know, of the...
It's more like a tantric thing, right?
Hatha, yeah, Hatha yogic Nari Shuddhi. He is proceeding along the line. If I was to summarize the whole Shuddhi process, you know, there are two key movements in the Shuddhi process. First one is the granting of independence to each one of these components,
mm-hmm.
so that they don't interfere with each other or dominate each other, and ultimately to reverse the domination kind of schema, so that, you know, from spirit to mind to vital to physical, there is a kind of a, you know, kind of directionality, rather than the mixed up, the jumbled directionality, and particularly the reverse directionality of body to vital to mind that we follow at present. So the first step towards that is really to, you know, disjoin the connections, so to say, give independence to each of them. And the second step is to, you know, and in the meantime, to subject to whatever extent to the rule of mind, to the rule of an enlightening buddhi, these other instruments. But the most important one the Shuddhi is dependent on is to establish equality. So to the extent that, you know, the dualities of, you know, attachment and repulsion are recognized, the Jnana Yoga of it comes in recognizing the operations of these dualities at each of these levels. So that's why there is such a careful analysis of these different varieties of dualities. So then to recognize that and to attack each one of them to bring in equality is the procedure that I find as what he's calling Shuddhi.
So it's more of, you know, first classifying them correctly so that then they can be dealt with separately, right?
Correct, yes, yes.
And the process of classifying itself in some way has a liberating effect, you know. I mean, even though it's only a mental liberation, so to say.
It does, absolutely. It does. It does.
And the other thing, I mean, I guess we can, without going into details, we'll probably take it up on Saturday or Sunday, was the interaction between the, you know, the nervous being and the vital, like the interaction between the vital and the physical. I guess it occurs through the nervous being. Is that right, Devashista?
Yeah, you see, he's talking about first in this distinction that he's making, he's talking about the sthula sharira.
Mm-hmm.
And then he doesn't even use the term sukshma sharira, but he jumps into antakarana. If you note that, basically, so that's the distinction he's making. But the sthula sharira, he is defining in terms over here. He is defining the sthula sharira as a kind of a mental vital complex.
I thought it was vital and physical. Prana and physical.
Sorry. That's exactly what I meant. Mistake. A physical vital complex. A sharira and prana complex. So that is, you know, where, you know, the beginnings of that combination take place. And he's talking of the nervous being as something which is partly physical, partly vital, through which the psychic prana flows. And then it also has a mental component, because this nervous being also taps into the chitta and manas, you see. That's why it is like a kind of a intermediate structure, you know, the psychic prana is that which mediates between all its various relations.
Yeah, most fascinating, these interactions.
Yeah.
And he's using that as, I mean, when he's speaking of the chitta, he's saying that it's basically recording everything, even though the conscious
Exactly.
mind may not have acknowledged it at the point of the experience or at the point of
Exactly.
interaction with the external consciousness.
Right. Yes, exactly. So that's what he's calling it, the subconscious mind stuff. And you know, it's everywhere. It's even in matter to some extent more latent, but it's certainly in a very predominant fashion in plants and animals. And that's what also is part of the nervous being. So you know, the nervous being taps into that aspect of the mentality. And then in the human being, you know, there's a greater, you know, repression of it, because more organized mind, which you know, is buoyed, you may say, by this chitta.
It's interesting you are speaking about the physical two recording it, because I think it was a letter or something that I read where he said that Sri Aurobindo was saying that that the right yogi could pick up a sword and go back and tell you or be able to intuit where the sword was used in the historically who used it, etc.
Yeah, correct. Absolutely,
Yeah,
you're
I'm not sure
absolutely
where the
right.
source is. I
That's
think this.
exactly by the power of chitta. That's how I understand it, at least. Exactly because there is chitta in it, that it stores the memory of its own past, and it is possible by, you know, contacting through the buddhi can contact the chitta and develop its powers to the extent that it derives from it whatever it wishes. He's talking about that in this chapter also. He's saying that usually we are subject to the, you know, sort of, I mean, incoherent movements of the chitta, throwing up certain memories into our mind based on other even more obscure factors. Maybe
Evolution.
again, the psychic prana, and beyond it, the kind of dualities of the vital physical being are kind of, you know, operating on the chitta to throw up certain memories into the mind. But if the separation can take place, then the mind can turn upon the chitta and derive from it whatever it wants. It can use
Beautiful.
it as a basis of a storehouse of memory. And there it goes beyond, in fact, one's own physical life, and it goes into even in the individual, the subliminal memory, which, you know, one can tap into, you know, the recordings of a variety of prenatal, you know, realities. In fact, what happens, you know, we keep hearing about these people who do these past life regressions. You know, what I feel happens is that they tap into the chitta to some extent, and in the process they start receiving these messages from the prenatal memory, which is nothing to do with the psychic being as such. It doesn't have to do with past births. But we are basically, to a large extent, our prakriti is a recycling of universal prakritic materials. So, you know, we have various parts in us that, you know, have their own pasts.
So it may not be
So,
that the person is going to the actual source, but that the person has from wherever that the person is able to go in the chitta, he's able to derive that information regardless.
exactly, exactly.
But that information may not belong to the person he's studying.
No. So
Okay.
that's the problem. But still, it has an effect on the being, because whatever is there in the memory is part of the matrix of forces that are operating in the life. So it does have an effect, but it's certainly not the identity. You know, so you know, something can be said about it, but you know, too much is made of it.
It's like astrology, that something can be said about the forces of the stars at the moment of birth, but
Right.
not too much, right? There
Exactly.
are too many forces acting on one being.
So, and again, this information in the chitta, which is more like historically what has been stored by the experience, is different than what Sri Aurobindo says, that you can, you know, get to any information. For example, I remember one of the letters in which he was not chiding, he was, you know, kidding with one of the sadhaks and saying that, surely you don't expect me to know the number of fish that were caught in Pondicherry yesterday.
Yeah.
And then he qualifies that by saying, of course, that too can be known by going to, I mean, I don't remember the spot, but some, I mean, spot meaning some spot in the consciousness. So, but that is not known from the chitta, right? That's from another like external source.
That is vijnana.
Oh, that is vijnana.
That is vijnana, because that is ultimately, you know, the one thing by which all may be known, that knowing which all may be known, you know. So that is essentially the knowledge aspect of the Brahman, through which by extension anything may be known.
So but
it's an aspect of knowledge by identity. If if I am identified with the one being there is, then I can extend my consciousness to know any aspect of myself and derive its contents, translating them into knowledge. So that is why. But there is an operation required there. That's the reason why, you know, as he says, you don't expect me to know how many fish they caught. We don't expect him to know how many fish they caught, is because intrinsically he's identified with everything, but to actually know it, there has to be an operation of chitta, of consciousness, by which he can extend his identity and translate the identity in terms of knowledge.
Okay. So that's, that's not sort of automatic, so to say.
It's not automatic, It's not automatic. But he was given to doing that. I mean, this was one of the operations by which Sri Aurobindo knew, you may say. Of course, the mother too, but this is one of the operations by which he knew. You know, you have that example. Whenever he needed to know, that's how he would come to know.
Sure.
You have that example of, I don't know if you all have read that it occurs in Niruddha's book, of the politician who was shot. Do either of you remember
that?
No,
I don't think I've read this.
Yeah, this was a Pondicherry politician who was connected with the ashram, in the sense that he had some sort of contact with the ashram, and Mother and Sri Aurobindo was sort of interested in knowing what was going on with him. And you know, there was some kind of uprising and he was shot. It was one of the political murders, you may say. But once he was shot, the news came. Niruddha came with the news, or somebody came with the news and said, you know, this has happened. He has been shot. So Sri Aurobindo sent Niruddha to the hospital to find out what had happened to him or what condition he was in. So he goes there and the doctor comes out, and the doctor said, he's alive, but you know, we are tending to him. So he goes back and tells Sri Aurobindo, well, this is what the doctor said. And Sri Aurobindo's response was, but I saw him dead on the operating table.
Very interesting.
You see, and then the news came that he had died, you see. So this, you know, ability, this is the ability. This is similar to how many fish did the Pondicherry fisherman catch? Almost exactly the same.
Sure,
you know?
Very much.
Yeah, so it is really by extension of his identity that, you know, if he tuned his consciousness, he would come to contact something, anything, as an aspect of his own consciousness, and then derive the knowledge out of it, either through a vision, as in this case, or through, you know, a stream of words, or some form by which that would translate itself into knowledge.
Sure. Does he not use say it as prakamya?
This is an aspect of prakamya. You're very right. This is an aspect of prakamya. So these are part of the vijnana siddhis.
So what you were telling previously about these people who read the past lives and such, what you're saying is that just like by yogic development, you can access your own chitta, the submental memory in all its fullness. It's possible for them to access other people's such chitta also. Is that what you were saying?
Yeah, no, not that they access other people's chitta. What this past life regression is doing is basically it is putting the, it's a form of hypnotism where it's putting the conscious mind under the threshold and, you know, it's putting it somewhat to sleep. And your consciousness from the chitta is sending up its images and its experiences, and you are relating them. So
it's only the subject itself is relating them. It's not
the subject relates in these past life regressions. Basically, the subject experiences and relates these things, and when they come back, they start believing that this is what I was in my past life, etc.
And of course, there's no way one can verify such things.
No, there's no way one can verify. And also the real thing, the real problem here is that, you know, it's the easy equation of any experience with any kind of ideology. You can create a theory that this is what has happened to you, but that's not necessarily what happened to you.
It's more like you are deriving the cause from a certain effect.
Exactly. The inner experience, it's like the people who, you know, fall under some kind of possession of some vital being. And then there is an easy equation of that with, you know, the mother entered into him, or, you know, Kali entered into him, etc. You know, that the you know, spirit possession or spiritism is, you know, easily equated with some kind of divine phenomenon.
But it could be any being, right?
It comes out of a simplistic view of the vast domains of the inner life.
Yeah. In a way, we are all looking for a simple solution that explains it, right?
Right.
So, the Vashishtha, I was reading the Aitareya Upanishad.
Yeah.
And there in one, towards the end of Sri Aurobindo's translation, one shloka has Sangyanam, Agyanam, Vijnanam and Pradyanam.
Correct. That's the place where it occurs.
So there he says Sangyanam is concept, Agyanam is will, Vijnanam is analysis and Pradyanam is wisdom.
Now this is again, I'm glad you brought it up, because this is again a matter of history, because this translation was carried out in Calcutta during the nationalist period, and his understanding of these four terms completely changed when he was in Pondicherry. So when we think about these four terms, when he's writing the Kena Upanishad, sort of commentary, that is very different from these four translated terms that you just mentioned, which is in the Aitareya translation.
And the Kena Upanishad, he did as part of Arya.
Correct.
Verse 14 to 20. Okay.
Correct. And his whole understanding of Vijnana had changed by then. You see, this is being done, this is being translated at a time perhaps even before the experience in the Alipur jail, when he got the, you know, key to the supermind, basically.
Okay, in that case, we don't have to remember these four mappings at all.
No, they are more confusing than because they are very different from the use he makes of them later. I myself, you're quite right. I was quite surprised when I came across those translations, and then I investigated into the historicity and found out that they were translated much earlier in the nationalist period, in the Calcutta period.
Yeah.
He may have even been in the Baroda period, because that's when he was, you know, even in the jail, he was reading Upanishads and Gita. But prior to that, he was regularly reading the Upanishads. Mm-hmm.
He was still a novice then.
Yeah, novice in his own terms.
That's why the common usage of the word Vijnanam is science, right?
Yes.
So it sounds more like the common usage of analysis or
reasonable analysis. Yeah. But there is a, you know, like Vijnana, like, you know, when you put prefix V in front of Jnana, Vishesha Jnana, it's kind of like a conditioned, or it's like a, you know, Jnana that is specialized in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
So idea of relativity, idea of relata, of some knowledge which has got relations, relational knowledge, is present in idea of Vijnana. That the reason that is so is because, you know, Vijnana includes the other three kinds of Jnana, you know, the Prajnana, Samjnana and Ajnana.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, in Prajnana, the relata become really manifest as independent realities. But Vijnana includes them as aspects of its own self. So the many, what we may say, the relationship between the one and the many, Vijnana is not the one in which there is no many. It is the one and the many experienced as the one.
That is the supramental knowledge.
That is the supramental knowledge. That's why Vijnana is also, you know, sort of in a summary fashion, another name for supermind itself.
Oh, I thought so in the final chapters, when he talks of the gradations of the supermind and he says the four levels.
Yeah.
But that includes all Vijnana, Prajnana, Sabjnana and Ajnana, correct?
Yes.
Not, like the translation of Vijnana to supermind is only a loose translation, right?
Or it is a loose, but also, you know, it is a certain kind of, I mean, it's like the one that includes the others.
Okay.
Yeah, it is.
So because
there's
a hierarchy
master,
within.
Master form of knowledge in the supermind.
Okay.
Like having a master key, you know, then from that you can specialize the form of knowledge into the others.
Okay.
But this is the basis, the foundation of knowledge in the supermind.
Uh-huh. And Devashisda, the other question was, is there a relation between the antakarana and the antakarana and the chakras in any way, or are they two separate schemas?
No, there is a relationship. There's definitely a relationship, because antakarana includes this entire inner being, but he doesn't go into that, but inner being does have nodes, one may say, and these nodes are the chakras. You know, one interesting thing is that notion of psychic prana, you may wonder where did he get it from when he hadn't yet developed the idea of the psychic being. Term psychic being actually is supposed to have come from the mother.
Uh-huh.
The term psychic being as such, yeah, that was the term itself came from the mother, and it was used before her, or she was using it in the kind of context of Theon's teaching.
Uh-huh.
Theon was already using it actually.
But that is the Chaitya Purusha.
Yeah.
Which
have, yeah, correct.
So
that's what I mean.
But
so,
we do see Chaitya Purusha in other texts, no?
No, the word psychic being.
The word, okay. But
the
concept
English word,
was
no, not
there,
the concept. The English word psychic being.
You know, regarding the concept, that's also very interesting. I don't know where it is, but I have read, you know, the Puraniji's writing, where he says that basically he had to fish it out. He said, you know, he was a Sanskritist. And so the Sri Aurobindo kind of had a close relationship with Puraniji in terms of Sanskrit terminology. And apparently he helped him to find that term. And in helping him to find that term, he said they both had a tough time, because it's not easily found, that term.
Mm-hmm.
in the Indian tradition.
Okay, so you do see Purusha everywhere, but Chaitya Purusha is what you don't see.
Yeah, it's not so common.
But without... Sorry, go ahead.
Yes, Shyam.
Yeah, so without that, when we have the concept of the rebirth and evolution, so it is just a loose definition of evolution rather than a strict way of, you know, the psychic being as the evolving soul in the past.
Exactly. So the entire theory of the psychic being as it relates to the theory of rebirth and as it relates to the theory of evolution of consciousness is very underdeveloped in the Indian tradition.
Uh-huh.
That's the reason why the theory of karma is so confusing. It ends up becoming some kind of a retributory theory of retribution, or causation.
Sure.
But what is at the base of it is not made clear.
Uh-huh.
So psychic being is not really given, you know, clear understanding or definition in the Indian philosophical literature at all.
Sure.
Antaratman is, so psychic entity is, that is the immanence of Purusha in every individual.
Mm-hmm.
That is the individualization that has entered into space and time. But the projection of Antaratman as psychic, as Chaitya Purusha, that is not developed in any considerable way.
Sure. To some degree also, I mean, the focus of the past was also the realization rather than the theorizing, right? Or was
it the realization, but it was really the realization of the static aspect and the realization of, you know, even if it was the inner realization, it was the realization of the static aspect within or the unformed aspect within.
Uh-huh.
Not so much the dynamic aspect which could bring about transformation.
Got it. So, Devashita, going back to the previous thing about the, you know, what is it, the nodes and the inner being. So, the inner being is where you one comes in contact with these different chakras, is it?
Yeah. So, when you're talking about, he's distinguishing these various kinds of minds, like emotional mind and, you know, the sort of, nervous being and different kinds of beings and minds. They form part of the, you know, topography of the inner being. But once one gets behind them to what are the various roots of the operation of this inner being, then one finds that the vital being has certain specific nodes, mental being has certain specific nodes, and these nodes are the chakras.
Uh-huh.
So those are the centers through which some of these operations take place, like the he uses the term dynamic mind. He breaks up the buddhi into, you know, the intelligence and the intelligent will.
Uh-huh.
So these operations are the center of the buddhi is the Angya Chakra. The center of the spiritual consciousness is the Sahasrara. Center of the emotional mind is the, you know, I think they call it the, Swadhisthana? The heart chakra, basically. I think they call it the Swadhisthana. And center of the vital being proper is the, you know, the vital center, etc. You know, so each one of these aspects of the of the inner being, Antakarana, has got a specific center, locality, which, you know, is its locus of operation. That is the chakra.
Okay. And in the Life Divine, when he says that the advantage of getting in contact with these inner being is that the inner vital, the inner mind, is that from here, it's more easy to contact the universal forces.
Correct.
And that is again via these nodes, is it? Or is it just...
Correct.
That they, okay.
No, absolutely. You're absolutely right. It's via these nodes.
Uh-huh.
Whether consciously or unconsciously, the kind of, you know, I mean, relationship between the individual consciousness and the universal consciousness is mediated by these centers.
Devashita, you were saying Sri Aurobindo found that term psychic prana?
Yeah, the term psychic prana he got from Vivekananda. So, yeah, we can talk a little bit about that, at the intensive. But basically, Vivekananda uses the term in his book Raja Yoga.
Ah, okay.
And he's using the term in two chapters there, chapter 4 and 5, specifically with respect to Kundalini Yoga as an aspect of Raja Yoga.
Which chapter 4 and 5?
In the book Raja Yoga by Vivekananda.
Uh-huh. Okay, I just heard one more reference. There was an old ashramite, Kodandarama. He was practicing pranayam from this book, Raja Yoga. And he asked Sri Aurobindo if it is needed, and Sri Aurobindo said, no, not needed.
So
he stopped pranayam.
I see. Yeah. So, you know, it depends. I mean, evidently it wasn't needed for him, and he is not asking everybody to do it either.
Yeah.
But, you know, Sri Aurobindo himself was practicing pranayama for quite some time.
Yeah, and 5-6 hours a day too at that time, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so, and at that time also is when he was reading works like Vivekananda's Raja Yoga, etc.
Mm-hmm.
So, the terminology at least he picked up, though he is using it, where the chapters in which he is using psychic prana are chapters in which he is talking about pranayama, in fact. And, you know, he's talking about how the prana spreads to, he's using it roughly, you can explain it as a mental kind of, that's how Sri Aurobindo uses it too. But he calls it a mental vitality. You'll find he uses that term, a mental vitality.
Vivekananda uses
No,
Sri Aurobindo.
Sri Aurobindo, mental vitality.
Yeah. Vivekananda, you can translate it into something like that.
So that's where the Nadi Shuddhi comes through pranayama.
Exactly. That's the link between the... psychic prana, the purification of the psychic prana and the nadi shuddhi. And I'm sure that's the relationship, at least in terms of, you know, the kind of, you know, lineage, genealogy of the terms.
And that's because Vivekananda was from the tantric school himself.
Well, not really, you know, but those two chapters are very interesting because, you know, I think he was really an Advaitin, but because Ramakrishna had such a strong grounding in Tantra, he must have picked up some of these aspects from him. Actually, Raja Yoga doesn't deal much with all this at all.
Advaitin.
So, the theory of the Kundalini and the chakras, he delineates the whole theory over there in those two chapters. And he's actually saying that, you know, I mean, in those chapters, Vivekananda is saying that any form of yoga you do, whether you do bhakti yoga, karma yoga, or jnana yoga, it involves the rising of the kundalini to some extent. He says you can use the power of, bhakti yoga, it basically will open up the chakra of the heart. But in that process, it will draw on the kundalini and make it rise to some extent or some aspect of it, he says. So that was very interesting. I've never read that anywhere else. Maybe he has some yogic insight that he's sharing over there. But, that's how he puts it at least.
Does the Kundalini itself have a direct translation in Sri Aurobindo's system, or he's?
Yeah, he does use the term, but he doesn't give it much importance.
Okay.
He talks about it in terms of the involved energy, at the base of the physical, and he says it must rise to meet the descending Shakti.
Uh-huh.
But, it doesn't, I mean, the ways he's described it in his letters, it is not necessary for it to rise like a sudden kind of, you know,
sure.
sort of, you know, like they describe in the tantric process, there is a, you know, a serpent which rises hissing in a very abrupt kind of lightning-like movement of the spine and all that.
Uh-huh.
There is no necessity for that kind of process. Rather, it can be a very gradual opening up of the energies streaming upwards,
mm-hmm.
You know, and a kind of a meeting of the higher and the lower that way.
Beautiful. Mm,
that whole graphic discussion of how the mother, Savitri, when she has united, how it comes down, the force comes down, and it's like the
there
meeting.
It is a very sudden movement, in fact. It's the whole thing is rising. Shown as a, almost mm-hmm. in as in the tantric process
mm-hmm.
there, because of course there he is, you know, showing it as a kind of a, you know, an event rather than a gradual process.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So okay, Devasa, in these chapters, he's also using ahankara as part of the antakarana.
Yeah, that is traditionally part of the antakarana.
Okay.
But I don't know if he says it is part of the antakarana. Does he finally say it is, or he doesn't really discuss it?
No, I think when he's describing in that very first of those three chapters, when he's describing the antakarana,
mm.
he includes ahankara there.
Mm.
Then afterwards, he doesn't give much importance to it.
Yeah.
But right at the end, you know, when he's talking the purification of the intelligence, towards the end, he'll bring it back. He'll say that, you know, at the center of the whole kind of ego sense,
mm-hmm.
he talks about it as ego sense. He doesn't use the term antakarana. He'll talk about the ego sense and how it has a basis in the separateness of the body and in the individual qualities of the vital, and ultimately how it comes to crystallize itself in the buddhi, because that is its, it becomes its seat, but that seat gets its support from the other two.
Devasiddha, I was reading the Aitireya, and
yeah.
There he says, Brahman,
yeah.
No, sorry, not Brahman, the Purusha that was cast into this creation was called Idandra.
Yeah.
And then the veil of unrevelation fell upon him.
Yeah.
So it's like the veil of the overmind, or the division. And
yeah.
Then he became
exactly.
Indra. He became the lord of the overmental
right.
overmind, Indra.
Right.
Is that the significance of Idandra, or there is more to it?
Yeah, actually, that I mean, in that Upanishad, that you know, that Upanishad is a very, very powerful. It's one of the old Upanishads. In fact, the reason Sri Aurobindo, I mean, my own sense is maybe if he went on writing, he would have actually revisited that Upanishad, because it carries so much. He took up the Kena Upanishad, and he himself, I mean, Kena and Isha are the two smallest Upanishads, or two of the smallest Upanishads. Of course, Mandukya is probably even smaller, but, you know, he took up these Upanishads as two sort of sample Upanishads that kind of, he said that the Kena is kind of more or less like a very basic fundamental Upanishad, and the Isha is a very advanced Upanishad. You know, between the two of them, they encapsulate most of the ideas.
Mm-hmm.
But the Kena is very closely related with the Aitireya in terms of that they almost form a kind of a you know, sort of duo, you know, kind of two together sort
mm-hmm.
of reality.
Mm-hmm.
But this Idandra, you know, is like saying this sees, you know, the drisht, you know, the dra is like a kind of a root of seeing,
okay?
And Idan is like Idam, you know, it's
this,
like this sees or this seeing, okay? So this power of seeing is what it's, you know, sort of, you know, like they're saying that that is the real name of Indra, but in the veil of unrevelation, it is known as Indra, right? Isn't
yes.
that what it's saying?
Yes, exactly.
Right. So, Idandra is like almost like the what Sri Aurobindo calls the sense of the sense. You see, that is the original supramental sense. In fact, it is the samjana. That is the origin of the senses. Indriya's Lord is Indra.
Mm.
But Indra's truth is Idandra. You see? So, they basically show you a hierarchy in yoga, in the yogic sort of progress of sensing. The power of sensing moves from the senses to the manas. Again, you can relate it to what we are studying. From the senses to the manas. Lord of the manas is Indra under the veil of the unrevelation. But beyond it, it is the purity of the supramental sense that is just known as this seeing. So instead of calling it the being or the Lord, it becomes just a faculty of supermind, this seeing.
Uh-huh.
That's how I understand it.
Uh-huh. It's there in this, towards the end of Life Divine, or is it here?
There's a chapter here called the supramental sense, which I read.
Supramental sense, correct.
Yeah.
I'm not
there's
very...
a chapter in the synthesis, and then if you look at the Kena Upanishad's commentaries, he has a whole chapter on that.
Okay, Sangyanam, supramental sense.
Yeah.
The divine sense, I think it is called.
Mm-hmm.
Sangyanam. Yeah, I haven't read it in a while, so I don't remember much of it.
And the other two, Agyanam and Pragyanam?
Agyanam and Pragyanam. Pragyana is very important. I mean, all four of them are very important. Pragyana is the root of mind. Because Pragyana is the one that brings the many out of the one and gives them independent reality. But it holds the two sides together. It holds the one and the many together.
That's the overmind.
No, that is... In fact, that is, I'd say that is at the kind of very cusp of the overmind.
Mm-hmm.
It's the truth of the overmind. It's that part where Sri Aurobindo says the overmind is separated from the supermind by a kind of a sheath of dissimilar similarity. He uses that term.
Mm-hmm.
So that very, kind of origin of the overmind is that faculty of supermind that we call prajnana. Just like the faculty of sensing becomes the god of the lord of the senses, so too the faculty of division becomes the power of divided reality. You see? So
that's prajnana. That's prajnana, okay.
Yeah, so prajnana by imposing a certain veil by a power of consciousness, it imposes a certain kind of a unrevelation, the veil of unrevelation upon its own, the multiplicity, so that the multiplicity cannot see the unity anymore, but the unity can see the multiplicity. That becomes the operation of overmind. That's the overmind maya. So prajnana is the root of mind, you may say. And then Agyana becomes the root of will, because by Agyana, the one possesses, it's just like we were talking about knowledge, as knowledge by identity which can extend itself and know itself, so too it can extend itself and operate upon itself. That is by power of Agyana.
Uh-huh. Okay, so in that translation of the Aitreya when Sri Aurobindo gave, at least Agyanam he equated to will.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
That is the knowledge will.
Yes, that's the knowledge will.
What is the other word? Real idea, no, that's different.
What does real idea mean? I keep hearing that word, but I never.
Pragyana.
Real idea is prajnana?
No, real idea is another way by which Sri Aurobindo talks of the supermind.
Okay, oh, it's a
distinguishes
synonym.
It from conceptual idea, a self-conceptualization by Brahman. Whatever Brahman self-conceptualizes is, becomes reality. It is reality, rather not becomes, but it is a becoming of reality, you may say. So, because it's the one being who is becoming. But if mind conceives, then it is a second order reality or a representation. The difference between real idea and idea is the difference between presentation and representation. So that's the reason why real idea is reality itself as idea, while the other one, mental idea, is the representation of reality as an idea. That's why it doesn't have the totality of reality in it. See, a mental creation will have only mental substance to it, even if it has a mentalized physical, a mentalized vital, etc. It will not have the totality of Brahman in it. You see, it has only mental reality in it. So that's the difference between real idea, and our world is a world of real idea, because there is an idea in it, but Brahman, entire infinity of Brahman is present in every aspect of its manifestation. While mental idea, whatever is conceived by mind, only is made up of mental substance, even though it may take on characteristics of vitality and physicality.
And when we say Brahman, where does the concept of Brahman fit into the seven layers of consciousness? Does it sit outside of the seven layers?
Yeah, Brahman, it sits outside and inside. Brahman, everything is Brahman. That is why all these are the part aspects of the real idea of Brahman.
Well, that is more
Brahman
like...
Brahman is the one being there is.
Okay, by definition.
There is nothing other than Brahman. And there is nothing else than Brahman.
Okay.
Debashita, is there any significance to the fact that Indra is the son of Aditi?
Yeah, in the sense that, you know, it, again, over here, it's, see, Indra is born from Aditi. Indra is, again, the lord of overmind, particularly in this sense that Aditi is the mother of unity, one without division.
Yeah.
And, you know, so she's the supramental Shakti. And so derived from supramental Shakti, that which is a subsidiary action of the supramental Shakti, that is Indra.
Indra, and who's the lord of Prajnana.
Yeah, lord of Prajnana and also of Samjnana.
Oh, also of Samjnana. Then all the Adityas would be related in that fashion.
Of course they are.
They are all aspects of this the divine,
correct.
Supreme Mother. Born of light, no? Kashyap means light.
Correct.
Light and Shakti.
What does it mean, some eight sons of Aditi?
Adityas. Actually, there are various places. Some places they say 8, some 12, some 10.
Those are the emanations. In fact, you know, those are the emanations of the supramental powers.
Aditi,
and,
right?
Yeah. And when it is, you know, and sometimes, you know, you can think of it even in terms of mother's symbol.
Yeah. The 12 powers.
The 4 and the 12. The 12 powers particularly. And then, you know, when it is talked, when it's spoken of as the 8, it relates to the 8 sons of the supermind that Sri Aurobindo talked about.
Oh, 8 sons of the supermind? No, we are
not
aware of that.
There are 7 sons of the supermind, that each one of them relate to one of the 7 layers. That's why supramental materiality, supramental vitality, supramental mentality, that kind of, you know, progression.
Sun in the S-O-N or S-U-N?
S-U-N.
S-U-N, okay.
S-U-N.
Oh.
And the final, the eighth one, is the one that is Markanda, who has entered into the unconscious and, you know, is involved, the involution of supermind, which is evolving. So that's the eighth son of the supermind, which is the dark son.
Markanda, right? That's his name?
Yeah.
Mara, the son from, he came to the death.
So, in essence, all this knowledge was, in essence, available much before Sri Aurobindo also, right?
Yeah, I mean, see, in the Vedas, you have all these symbolic, you know, kind of ideas. But, you know, how to piece it together? What can you make of it? Nobody has been able to make anything of it.
Okay.
The reason they haven't been able to make anything of it is that it's not given in a kind of a, you know, sort of coherent manner. Same for the Upanishads, for that matter. The Upanishads are, you know, the Vedanta, the root or essence of the Veda, but it is not given in a coherent form that you can derive a philosophy out of it. So, and as far as the Veda is concerned, you know, Sri Aurobindo himself is saying that we have only a fragmented part of the Veda. A lot of the Veda is lost.
Okay.
So,
even Upanishads, no? A lot is lost.
Maybe. I mean, we don't know. He hasn't said anything as such. But of course, there are many Upanishads. There's I mean, the traditional list is 108. But there are more than that, which are available also. We don't look at them very much because it's been reduced to 13 or 12 or 10. But there's a very vast body of Upanishads. Yet you can't make too much of it because it's not coherent, you see. So that's where, you know, I mean, that's the reason why, you know, when people try to say that Sri Aurobindo got his philosophy from the Veda or the Upanishad, it's really impossible to get a philosophy from the Veda or Upanishad. He got it all and then he saw it, you know, he didn't see it in the Veda and Upanishad.
You can't do it with the mind.
You cannot do it from the text.
So the story of the seven sons of the supermind and the eighth, is that in the Vedas?
Yeah, it's in the Vedas.
So I think before the retreat, it will be good to read that scribal version.
Yes, very much so.
Okay.
That will be useful. I think that will be very useful.
It's just 2 pages.
In fact, it has some things there which are not in the in the chapters as well. So it's useful.
Okay.
So you all are setting out tomorrow?
We'll start tomorrow afternoon at about 3 or so. That's the current plan.
We don't know for sure if Bindu is coming.
No, as of yesterday, today morning, she said
she
would...
Did she write you, Devashisda?
No.
Yeah, I think she's hesitating.
No, yesterday morning, her thing was, yes, I would very much like to come and I can be at your place at 2 p.m. on Friday. But after that, she hasn't responded.
Yeah, I think she's hesitant. She's not ready. I mean, she was gone out for a long time somewhere. She hasn't prepared the reading and something like that.
Yeah, you can encourage her that she doesn't need to worry about reading.
Especially since she's only here for a short while and she joins the class regularly via Skype. It might be good to interact with this.
Yeah,
sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, that's what you're saying. Tomorrow we are going to start at about 3.
Yeah, 3 or so is the plan.
And we'll go to the apartment that Louise has. And
Good.
10 o'clock we should be there
Okay,
in
wonderful.
Vicky's house.
Right. Okay, good.
Yeah. So
So
perhaps
okay then, look forward to seeing you soon.
yes, Debashish, we are also looking forward to this. Like most chapters, this also feels like the whole of the yoga is there in it. So it'll be
This is like the real idea. Everything is in one
that
little
that is the real idea, in fact.
capsule. Capsule of.
That's why it is the integral reality.
Yes, but that said, I mean, despite, I mean, even without that, planes and parts are, I guess, in a way, very central.
Yeah.
So at least I'm always excited by it. So it should be a good weekend.
Sure.
Is it very hot out there now?
Yeah, it actually today was very pleasant over here. I mean, yesterday was very hot, but from yesterday evening it's been very nice. It's been nice breeze has been blowing.
Oh, okay. And at night, does it remain hot or it cools down?
No, at least I don't know about exactly about that area, but here, it's been quite cool. I mean, in general, I think every evening it goes down to the 60s or so.
Oh, that's
So,
really cool.
yeah, I'm maybe,
Yeah, we should be okay, totally.
yeah. I think it should be fine. There may be fan also. Tomorrow I'm going to go out there to Vicky's place.
Oh, you are
And
okay.
also, yeah, Diana and I'll be meeting Diana and Luis, and I'll just make sure everything is okay, both at the other place. And I think Luis is also very conscientious about these things. So
Yeah,
I saw she sent
she
an
used to
email
join
about
the
it.
yeah, she used to join regularly before, but of late we haven't seen her.
That's because she has some, she's having some personal issues,
Oh,
she's
really? Okay.
difficult to make the time, pressures.
Okay, Debashish, in that case, we won't keep you anymore. We'll see you on a Saturday morning then.
Okay, sure.
Yes,
Thank you.
Debashish. Yeah, thank you very much, and we'll continue on Saturday morning.
All right. Bye. What is suddenly? Hey, did you switch off the Audacity?